News Talk 99.7 WNTK, AM 1490, FM 98.9 WUVR. Welcome back to another edition of our program with George Neuwirth of George Neuwirth Construction and Trusted Rentals Automotive. The past few weeks, we've been talking about various home-related matters, including insulating and
efficiency, like home efficiency.
Efficiency, building house, like the steps involved in that. Last week, we talked about the electric world that we live in.
Right. How do you know how well your house is performing based on the feedback it gives you, like icicles and heat loss and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Doors and windows, don't forget that.
Doors and windows, yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. Yeah, just kind of rolling through and just kind of piece by piece, giving homeowners some advice on things you can do to potentially save some money and get your house in a little bit better shape.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So today's topic, we're going to touch on a few of them. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk about the homes we build today are different from homes that we used to build. So for instance, a house of 30, 40 years ago, I would say, you know, they were still built with all rough sawn lumber. They were built with hemlock. They were built with whatever lumber, whatever trees were plentiful and readily available in whatever region that we live in. So, you know, primarily hemlock was our choice of home building back then, and homes were just built differently. So today's show, I just wanted to talk about the types of styles of homes we build today and the way that the style and floor plans and layouts are changing based on people's preferences. And so I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that. And then I also wanted to talk about the trades. So we obviously have a significant number of trades in our home building process. And I just wanted to touch on what is happening in the trades today. And there's some significant parts of this that I feel are important, and also maybe clarify a few things to present opportunities to young people or whatever. Anybody can do it. It's not just young people, but trying to create an argument for kids being encouraged to go into the trades instead of possibly going to a four-year college. So that was kind of like what I wanted to do today.
Yeah. How are floor plans changing these days? I feel like everyone's trying to build bigger.
Floor plans today, basically, what people want is, during COVID, the average square foot of a house was dropping. I think it was around 2,000 or 2,200 square feet.
Yeah.
And since COVID, like, the square footage of houses has jumped back up. You would think that during COVID, the house size would be larger so that people could not see each other in rooms for days and weeks at a time.
Right.
But, you know, there was a lot of drivers to that fact. And so it seems like, you know, energy prices drive the size of homes, and, you know, there's a lot of different factors. There's people having less kids. They're spending more time in their schooling, their careers, their professions. They're adopting more dogs and cats, waiting to have children later in life. The main style difference that we see in homes today is that people want more open concepts. Like, they want to be able to come into a house and have a central gathering place, like an old town hall kind of thing, where you come in, you have the kitchen, you have living room, dining room. Typically, that's how we design things today. Kitchen, living, and dining is kind of one room. And then you have your private areas, you have your bedrooms and bathrooms and that kind of thing. But traditionally, say a first floor, close to 50% of a first floor can be living, dining room, and kitchen. And then the trend is today, first floor master bedrooms with master baths, making them suites. We've seen one humongous bedroom on the first floor. We've seen two bedrooms, both with bathrooms, ensuite bathrooms. The whole trend towards homes today is for, seems like it's just for entertaining. And so, that being said, we have some problems with that. And the main problem we have with that is that when homes of years gone by were built, there was only so many feet that you could have for open space because the lumber wasn't strong enough to handle the spans. And what I mean by that is that if you have a 28-foot wide cape and you have a center carrying beam, that means that each section of the house, or the opposing sides of that 28 feet, 14 feet either side, could be carried by conventional lumber and have a floor plan like that. But today's houses, I mean, people want, they want 30 feet, they want 36 feet, they want, and so when you start entering the realm of 18 feet of carrying on either side of a beam, it becomes very difficult to build a home with dimensional lumber, which I mean, what I mean by that is like a traditional 2x10, 2x12 that will span that distance. And you can increase the spacing, or decrease the spacing, I should say, which means instead of 16 on center for floor joist, you can go 12 inch on center, but it makes running mechanicals and plumbing and drains and all that very difficult. So you can decrease the span of the floor framing pieces to create wider and wider, more open concept houses, but then you start spending more money on lumber, and it just kind of becomes a pain in the neck for subcontractors to do their thing. So what they did was, what they did, I don't know who they is exactly, but in order to meet the trends of home building with these wide open floor plans, is that they started building these truss systems, which is, we talked about earlier in one of my shows about the floor truss system. It's made from spruce, it's made from kiln-dried lumber, but instead of having a conventional piece of 2x12, like you whack down a tree and then you saw it into pieces and you dry those pieces and you use those for joists. Mm-hmm. Now they have engineered floor joists, which is basically like they have two primary systems. One is an open web truss. It's called a System 2000 that I buy primarily through Bellitates. Mm-hmm. And Lavalley's has these two, I think. But, you know, Lavalley's has in stock, they have these systems called truss joist, which is a web truss floor joist that has plywood in between the top and bottom cord. So you have chipboard pieces glued, like imagine taking a sheet of a half inch plywood or half inch OSB, like oriented strand board, and you mill it into 12 inch wide pieces, and then you glue a top and bottom cord to each one of these pieces. And the strength of these pieces, like you can go really long with these pieces. I think they ship them down the road at 60 feet. Wow. And I mean, you can cut, depending on the type of joist, they come in different sizes. They come in different heights and different weight classifications for whatever load that you're trying to put on them. I mean, you can have, you know, spans in excess of 20 feet that these joists will carry.
I'm always interested in that because I always kind of felt traditionally that, I mean, at least my limited understanding of home building and whatnot, that solid wood was always the best option in terms of strength.
Right.
But that apparently isn't the case anymore.
No. So it's definitely not the case anymore because wood just, I mean, there's two problems. First of all, that wood inherently just doesn't have the density.
Yeah.
Of the today's wood doesn't have the density or the tightness of the grain of old wood because mm-hmm. we're into like second generation growth.
Right.
And the type of wood that we use for framing, I mean, we could use oak, like something really dense, mm-hmm. like they did shipbuilding out of.
Right.
The wood choices that we have today is kind of like, I don't know, it's somewhat environmental. I think you use less wood building a house today, mm-hmm. volume-wise. So there is a certain aspect to the new homes that's a little more friendly, but we end up using more glues too. So
right.
It's kind of, does it equal out in the end? I don't really know.
I'm kind of surprised that the trend is, I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing the trend kind of plateauing and then kind of going back mm-hmm. down in terms of square footage, just because everything's so expensive with inflation the last few years.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And then interest rates. And so right. that is a good point because I remember not too long ago, I think the town of Warner had problems with, there was a developer that came into town that wanted to build tiny houses.
Oh, yep.
And there are some companies out there today that are basically building conventional wood houses on trailers.
Mm-hmm.
So you clear a lot and you back a trailer house in.
Yeah.
And it's not a mobile home, although it can still have wheels under it.
Right.
But it's basically a traditional house that people love that feel and, you know,
I
it's
like
wood.
I like the smaller house feel. Like I never have had ambitions to have a giant house with a bunch of vacant rooms that I don't use. It doesn't make sense to me. Like it's just heating
right.
and cooling, just
right.
unused space.
Right.
That said, I don't know if I could really go the full tiny house route
yeah.
just because that's really small.
Yeah. I'm actually going to have an open house soon on the house I live in. Like I live in George's Mills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first house on Old Main Street. I have a dog fence out front. It's a cedar colored. It's basically a 24x24 garage with two vehicles under. And I live above it, like single floor living above it. It's 525 square feet.
Yeah.
One bedroom, bath, living room, and kitchen. It's very simple. So my carrying costs are very low.
Right.
Like, and I love it.
Yeah.
It's just simple.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my house is, I think I have like between the two living floors, I think I have something around like 1,100, 1,200 square feet.
Right.
And honestly, even that, I mean, I could do with probably 2/3 of that just fine.
Right.
Even half.
Right. So I think you're probably right. You touched on that a little bit with people having less kids and or waiting longer to have kids. I think that there is a substantial increase in market where people do want smaller houses. And I think it's really cool because your carrying cost is less. If you look at the emphasis that people would like on their lives, you know, the trend of maintenance and the trend of mowing lawns and the whole trend of upkeep, I think is kind of like waning because people are just sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a demographic too, with 80 million Americans, like 55 and over. There is a certain demographic that's driving that, but I think it's driving them into condos and places where there's low maintenance so that they can spend their time traveling and, you know, having an RV and traveling around and doing stuff like that.
I feel like this generation these days is kind of just having, I feel like there's a fundamental shift where you're kind of seeing people just question traditional things that have just always been the way they are.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, the same with, you know, with just lawns. You know, I mean, you're starting to see a lot of people say, like, okay, well, you know, do I need 5 acres of mowed lawn or can I make a lot of it?
I hate my lawn. I hate it. And I have an electric lawnmower and I hate it.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that, no, what do? You pay someone else to do it? Like, it's just.
All right.
So it's kind of an interesting, we're definitely experiencing aspects of our existence that are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like for me, I want to travel more. I don't want to have to, you know, I don't want a big lawn that needs trimming. Like, I could certainly pay someone to do it. And I like the look. I definitely don't want to go through the process of weeding the beds and pulling and doing the trimming every spring and every fall. Like, I don't want to do that. Bark mulching. Like, how many times? It just seems to be an endless cycle. And I want to travel more. So,
Well, yeah. And I do think that's also another trend is that, you know, this, I feel like COVID really had a pretty profound, I think more than just the isolation and the, you know, whatever of the short term of it. I think really more so, it really kind of acted as a catalyst to kind of make people reevaluate what was important in their lives. And I think that's why you're starting to see a lot of things change in that respect, you know, like smaller living, more affordable living, you know, being able to, you know, not be so tied down financially with just your house that you can go out and do things like travel and enjoy your life.
Toys.
Yeah. Right. Just anything, you know, just, you know, spreading out the money that is ever fleeting.
Yeah. COVID didn't do much. I think the divorce lawyers during COVID did it. They're doing awesome.
I'm sure they're doing fantastic.
They're really doing awesome. You can't find a divorce lawyer to save your life.
Right.
Okay. So what I wanted to touch on with the home building, the way we build houses today, there's a couple inherent problems that we have with these houses.
Yep.
So I want to kind of like finish out this home chapter, and that the problem we have with homes today is that the concepts are great. Everybody walks in, there's a big wow factor. Like, we're so visual today. We have the huge big screen TV on the wall, and we have couches, and we have sofas and love chairs and dining room tables. And it's like such a visual wow when you walk into someone's house, or the houses we build, like, they're very visually appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with these houses is that when they catch fire, they're like an inferno, and they go up quickly.
Because of all the glue and everything?
Yeah. So, well, the glue in the wide open spaces. So I'm not going to have these numbers exactly right, but let me just throw some statistics out there that are close in concept. They're not going to be like down to the minute, but they're close. For instance, I have talked to a lot of people, you know, Howard Sargent was on the fire department in Sunapee, and I've talked to different people at different fire departments and talked to them. Bruce Adams is a firefighter out in Unity, and we talked to these people about different calls, and, you know, sometimes Bruce works with us on a job and, you know, his pager's going off and I'm like, oh, what the heck's that? And, you know, I remember one memorable one he had recently where some older guy was hanging Christmas lights and fell off his ladder or something like that. Like, we hear it all.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
But when you think about the way that homes are built today, there's basically more air around them. There's more wide open spaces in the rooms. Like, the fires have more fuel. So there's a couple things in that. This is a statistic that's probably going to scare a lot of people. If you have one of these wide open houses, and people that live in a wide open house can kind of like, you look around and you can kind of tell, like, if your kitchen, living room, and dining room are combined in any size, shape, or form, you're probably living in one of these houses.
Yeah.
And the failure rate, meaning the time that it takes for the house to be unsafe to go into once it's engulfed in flames, is around, okay, so let's back up. The old style conventional houses, the ones built with regular lumber.
Yeah.
The failure rate on these homes, from what I understand, the failure rate's like 11 to 11 and a half minutes with a response time from the fire department of around 8 minutes. So mm-hmm. that means when the fire department gets to your house, you basically have 3 minutes to get your Fido, your dog or cat or yeah. your fish from your fish bowl or your family, a family heirloom or two or you know, your photo albums or, you know, some important stuff. You have 3 minutes mm-hmm. before the house is unsafe to go into.
Yep.
The failure rate of an old school house is the way it is because of the mass, because of the volume of wood that has to burn. And so the fire department gets there and there's actually a little time left. Mm-hmm. Today's houses, the lightweight houses, on average, their failure rate is about 8 minutes, ugh. 8 to 8.5 minutes. So basically by the time the fire department gets there, it's too late.
Wow.
So I'm probably going to catch some flack for this, but one of the reasons why, I mean, New Hampshire is very hesitant and, you know, we're the last state to basically do anything because we live free or die or live free and die. We have a resistance to change. But one of the reasons why I feel like sprinkler systems in houses are going to be mandatory is because the failure rate is so fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if those sprinkler systems can slow down the rate of failure, even by a minute or two, it right. could be the difference between getting your pets out or getting an elderly or handicapped parent out mm-hmm. or relative that's living there. There's so many implications. There's so many different ways in which we could evaluate our own circumstances and say, you know what, that 2 or 3 minutes is really going to be significant to me.
Yeah.
And so when you say houses may go back to conventional lumber or built traditionally, you know, there are some arguments for it, but the trend is that people really like their open concept houses. They like the visual aspect of the wow. And so people just don't consider the fact that the failure rate in we call them lightweight houses, the failure rate in a lightweight houses is in a lot of ways the same time it takes to the fire department to actually get to your place.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. That's scary.
It is scary.
Yeah. No,
honestly, I mean, these are things we don't think about.
Right.
So us in the trades, when we see these things, I wanted to relate something else also that really has a significance on homes from the standpoint of burning. And that mm-hmm. is, we were at a job recently where the house had a standing seam roof on it. I know there's tons of you out there that have standing seam roofs. And what happens in a standing seam roof is that the fire actually gets held into the house because the flame can't escape. So what it does is it goes out the windows, it goes out the doors, like the pressure builds up, but the house cooks like it has a lid on it.
Yeah, I mean, it essentially be like a convection oven.
The smoke damage yeah. is so much more severe.
Well, it makes sense, yeah, because I mean, if it doesn't have a wood top to, you know, cooks. Break through, then
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it literally cooks. Would act as an oven, yeah.
Right, so yeah. so instead of a fire starting in one part of the house and like going up through the roof and your house is compartmentalized and you're like, oh, the fire started on that end and worked this way. What happened is because of the standing seam roofs, the fire actually moves through the house horizontally. It moves through the roof system and it moves through the floor system so that the smoke damage is so much more significant. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's like a whole house versus a room. Or,
I know, you think your house has got a lid on it.
Right.
So right. that is kind of one of the things that people should be considering in their decision-making of, I'm not a fan of standing seam roofs. I will say that over and over again. I think it has its place, but standing seam roofs seem to be one of these things where people just feel good about it. Like, oh, my house has got metal on it, and it's going to be like, you know, oh, it's going to last forever. But, you know, if you look at any of these roofs, like Englert is a good, you know, manufacturer of metal roofing. I think the warranty is only on the finish, and the warranty is like 30 or 40 years where we put, you know, architectural shingles from GAF, which is my preferred brand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can have a 50-year, we call them lifetime shingle roof. And that roof is it's awesome because it holds the weather on it like the ground.
Yep.
And so just from the standpoint, I know we can diverge into like this, the conversation has legs. It just keeps growing. Yeah. So, you know, just from the standpoint of the homes we have today, failure rate on the homes is very significant. So I would just like people to think about, you know, I've had two fires myself, and fire is one of those things that there's also a raised level of risk. If you have certain things, say, for instance, if you have a wood stove or several wood stoves, mm-hmm. obviously the risk to your home is going to be more significant if you have these things.
And yeah, we had a couple of chimney fires when I was growing up. Yeah,
exactly. So I just wanted to raise people's level of awareness that there are things going on behind the scenes when you make decisions to build either a lightweight house, whether you put a standing seam roof on it. Like, there are implications that you might not realize, but they can be very significant under the right circumstances.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah.
So I wanted to just kind of bring that whole thing full circle.
Right.
And we're going to get into next week. We don't have time for, I don't know where the time goes. That was 25 minutes.
It's fast.
It goes fast. Yeah. So one of the things I want to get into next week, this actually helps me out a little bit because I've got some homework done on this particular topic, but I don't have as much research or as much homework as I would like to. And that is dealing with the trades. And
yeah.
You know, the trades of building homes today, it doesn't make any difference whether you're working in downtown Boston at a high rise or whether you're working in your local community center or you're building a house for yourself. Whatever you're doing, you require trades.
Mm-hmm.
A house is no good to anybody unless you can flush the toilet, unless you can wash your hands and take a shower. It's just the way it is. So we always look at those benchmarks of home occupation as being like the significance of the home really matters the most. You can build the most beautiful house in the world, but if the toilet doesn't flush and people can't take a shower, like they would just assume.
Then it's just a wooden box in the woods.
They just assume go to the gym.
Right.
Right. It's just a wooden box at that point.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do was I want to touch on this week and next week. I want to touch on the trades. And what I mean by that is this is actually working out pretty good because I think that I would like people to weigh in on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to just touch on this a little bit because there is a significance here that I think is being hugely overlooked. And I think it needs to be reevaluated from a parental level. Parents, everybody thinks that four-year college, I never went to college.
Mm-hmm.
I never did.
Mm-hmm.
It was never an option to me because I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a Jehovah's Witness from the time I was five, if you consider that, when my parents divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And till the time I was baptized as a Jehovah's Witness, and I stopped being Jehovah's Witness. I decided to opt out for a variety of reasons when I was 27.
Mm-hmm.
And higher education was never, that's another chapter altogether, higher education was never available to me. And so the trades were honestly the only thing that we had that we could do.
Yeah.
Because if you engaged higher education, you were like pursuing the devil's work. Like, you know, material pursuits, which were not something that was encouraged. So in today's world, I understand that there are trades, nursing, being a doctor, lawyer, like there's so many trades out there that require higher education. But I just want to touch on the fact that you parents out there, it would be really great, even if your children are 3 years old, it would be really great if you could consider, I'm not asking you to turn the educational world on its ear, but I would like you to consider the value or the value system of the trades. And specifically what I mean by the trades is being a carpenter, being a contractor, being a roofer, being a plumber, being an electrician, being an HVAC, air conditioning, being a gas fitter. There's so many aspects of construction today that are commanding large salaries. And there is certainly an argument to be made for if I have that plaque on the wall, I'm going to obviously provide a good living for myself. But what I need people to consider is that in today's world, we have no young kids getting into the trades. I just want to present this one fact. I have a scholarship. I have a scholarship at Sunapee High School. I live in Sunapee. I support my town as much as I can. I was on the zoning board for 3 years. I try to consider Sunapee townspeople as my field. Like, that's where mm-hmm. I live. It's not that I don't work in other towns. We're finishing a nice job in Newport on Unity Road. Like, I will work in other towns, but everybody knows kind of how I feel about my town. I really love my town.
Mm-hmm.
So I offer a scholarship to the 28 or 30 kids in any graduating class for the trades, meaning they could go to plumber's school. They could work as a plumber, and the money, it's $2,500 a year for kids to engage in a program of education outside of the 4-year typical thing the kids do.
Yeah.
Or parents encourage their kids to do.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's kind of a little ridiculous that an 18-year-old decides to go to college and knows what he's going to do and spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he knows what he's going to do for the rest of his life. When it is very apparent that the average person changes vocations three times in their life.
Right.
That means they're going to last 15 years in each vocation, meaning trade, whether it's lawyer, nurse, doctor, whatever
right.
it is.
Right.
15 years.
Yeah.
I offer this scholarship to the town of Sunapee for their high school graduates. And the reality is there's not many graduates. You know, I think Sunapee varies between 24 and 30 kids on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, there has been three kids. So this scholarship has been available, I think, for five. Jackie Watkins could probably correct me on this one. But there's been the scholarship's been available, I think, for 6 years. And mm-hmm. I've only had three kids take me up on it.
Wow.
Three kids. One was a gal that went to welder school, and another kid went to Ohio Diesel Technical Institute. So those are the kind of things that I offer the scholarship for. Last year, no kids. Year before, no kids.
Jeez.
So what I did was I opened the scholarship up to my alma mater, which is Lebanon High School. There was 187 kids in my graduating class. And I happened to meet Ian Smith, who's the president of Lebanon High School. I met him at a funeral and we got talking, and I knew him. I remember him from high school because I think he graduated a year before me. And so I offered the scholarship up to Lebanon High School. And there's 180 some odd kids in their graduating class last year.
Yep.
We stretched it and we offered it to a kid who was going to Keene State College for construction management.
Mm.
Not technically trades.
He's in the field, I guess.
He's in the field. So we stretched it a little bit. So yeah. I offered, and so I presented at the Lebanon Opera House at their graduation or their awards ceremony. I offered it. So 30 some odd kids from Sunapee and 180 kids from Lebanon. Not one child last year went in the trades. Yeah. Electrical, plumbing.
That's scary.
Like this scholarship is even being offered to, let's just say I get contacted by some, you know, the guidance counselor in Lebanon, and she says, well, you know, Johnny Jump Up is going to work for Dickinson and Son Plumbing, and he could really use some money for support, or I could pay for his plumbing school, which is like $1,200 a year for that. Like, you know, can we just change things up a little bit so that, you know, the money's being put to good use? So there's 210 kids in a graduating class in our direct vicinity, and nobody is going in the field of trade.
Which is just baffling to me. I mean, when you think about the fact that these are infrastructure jobs that just keep society running.
And can't understand it.
And there's just fewer and fewer people doing it.
Right.
And the thing is, like, I don't know. Yeah, again, I don't know if there's like a stigma against not going to college, or, you know, if people think that that's the only way to make decent money. But there's so many jobs out there that pay so well. And honestly, I feel like in a lot of cases, people in the trades that have, you know, gained years of experience doing it even are better off than potentially people that have gone to school for 4 years, have bachelor's degrees and next. I mean, how many times do you see in the news, you know, people in IT or, you know, finance or whatever, you know, go to school for 4 years, get a degree, and then they're working as a cashier somewhere, you know?
Because they're too young. They're too young to decide what.
Well, they're too young, and the jobs aren't necessarily there.
Right.
I mean, trades are always going to be there.
Right.
You're always going to need electricians. You're always going to need plumbers. You know,
okay.
It's something that's always going to be part of society.
Okay, so we're out of time. So this is the hook for next week's show. And the hook is that I'm going to be specific. If you're going to be a plumber, here's what is necessary for you to be a plumber. How many hours of apprenticeship? What the structure is professionally on how we go about encouraging our children. And I honestly think the reason why we're not encouraging our children is because we don't know. Parents don't know.
You're right.
And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to be specific. So the trades I'm going to focus on is plumbing, electrical, HVAC, heating, and gas fitting. Those trades have specific guidelines for how we can encourage our kids to enter these fields and make a substantial amount of money.
Yeah.
Substantial. I mean, to be honest, the plumbing and electrical field will approach lawyer's fees.
Oh, absolutely.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, especially as the demand goes up and the supply of plumbers and electricians goes down.
The average age of a plumber in the state of New Hampshire is 64 years old.
Yeah.
Average.
Right. Yeah.
So.
And people are going to be able to charge whatever they want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to do next show. I'm just trying to raise parents or kids, if you're listening in your car going down the road right now, listening to this show, I'm just trying to raise levels of awareness of what the avenues are and what the procedures are for kids today that want to, right, or have an aptitude for entering the trades. For instance, when I raised my son, Ryan, we did things like he worked with plumbing and electrical, like he was on the jobs all the time in case something struck his fancy where he'd be like, Dad, you know, I want to do this, or I want to see what this is all about. He didn't end up doing that, but things come full circle. As you know, he's now a septic designer and septic designer for me. He's 27, a little more mature, and he's really doing a good job at that. So next week, we're going to get specific. Again, it's not going to be like, I'm not going to have my I's dotted, my T's crossed 100%, but I'm going to try to pave an avenue of understanding so that parents and kids can have enough information to decide whether or not what I'm proposing is worth exploring.
Yeah. And if you have any questions for next week's show ahead of time, you can feel free to email me, Matt, M-A-T-T, at WNTK.com. Don't forget, you can listen to any previous episode, including this one, on the podcast at WNTK.com. And we will talk to you about the trades next Friday at 8:30 on News Talk 99.7 WNTK, AM 1490, FM 98.9 WUVR.